Reber versus Acevedo. Mr. Blackman.
May it please the court, your honors, opposing counsel. Thank you for having me here this morning. I'm here on behalf of, my name is John Backman. I'm here on behalf of Scott Reber, the petitioner and formerly the defendant in the state court proceedings. Your honors, when my client was tried for this case back in 2000, he was incompetent to stand trial. We haven't had a chance to prove that yet, but I believe and frankly, I believe the burden is such, and I think this is an important issue, it's really the state that needs to prove that he was competent. If they can't, they need to retry him. I think this is a particularly important issue here, because if you look back at the proceedings, which the records before your honors, you'll note that there's a very strong likelihood that my client should not have been convicted of the sexual crimes that are the foremost reason that he had received a 33-year sentence. No doubt, everybody's admitted since day one, he did in a jealous rage beat up his girlfriend. We've never denied that. He didn't deny it when he testified, but he did not commit the sexual crimes at issue here. The evidence is pretty clear, and although that's not the issues on appeal, I stress them, that not the issues in the habeas, I stress them because they go to why this is such an important issue. He, at the time he was tried, he was not competent to be tried. He was not competent to participate with his counsel in a way that I believe would have resulted in his acquittal on the charges that have placed him in prison for so much of his life.
But let me ask you this. One of the things the state raises in its brief, if I'm understanding it correctly, is that once you have the state court findings that he was actually competent to stand trial, I think they're really arguing that the predicate procedural issue kind of washes away. If he really was competent to stand trial, why does it matter anymore whether there were two hearings or four hearings or, you know, lots of people testifying or not? Assuming that finding of fact meets the relevant standards under AEDPA, et cetera?
Your Honor, I appreciate that question. It really is the crux of what's going on here. As I understand the system that's established by the Lewis case and the other cases of this court, we have to show two things. We have to show that there was a bona fide, that is, petitioner, that there was a bona fide doubt as to his fitness, as to Mr. Reber's fitness at the time he was tried, and that the procedures utilized at the time to determine his fitness were inadequate, procedurally invalid.
Where does that come from the Supreme Court's decisions at this point? Certainly the Supreme Court says you can't try somebody who's not mentally competent. The person's got to be able to assist their lawyer and so forth. But where do the precise Lewis kind of procedures get their grounding in Supreme Court opinions?
Well, let me say a couple of things on that. I think the Pate case and the Drobe case indicate that there's both, and I think the state has basically conceded there's a procedural aspect here, which I think the state has agreed is met by having this test of bona fide doubt, which Illinois has adopted, and the Supreme Court appears in the Drobe case to have been okay with, and to say, yes, that's a reasonable way of approaching the procedural burden. The state's argument is twofold. I think they agree with our predicate, with the test we've established. What they're saying, though, is, and they don't really disagree that the proceedings back in May 2000, which Judge Bernardi himself said was not really a restoration hearing. I mean, my client had been found unfit. He had tried to commit suicide. He'd been found unfit twice. Dr. Chapman had agreed he was clearly unfit. Then there was this report by the department, by the local county department. No real hearing held, and he's put on trial. I think the state basically acknowledges implicitly that those procedures were not legitimate. But the state says, but there was no bona fide doubt. And then they get to the point which Your Honor was getting to, which is, and in any event, we had the chance and didn't prove in the retrospective hearing in 2005 that he was unfit. And I think, Your Honors, if you find that we had the burden, that is, if you find that in the hearings that were conducted in 2005 by Judge Bernardi, the petitioner had the burden of meeting that substantive threshold that the state has raised, then we lose. Because for reasons that I don't understand, but I wasn't the attorney for my client in the state post-conviction proceedings at the trial level. I believe I got involved at the appeal. But at the trial level, for whatever reason, the public defender that was appointed to the case did not put on any evidence other than Dr. Chapman, who said there's no way to know. Now, I think Ms. Davis, the public defender, who I have a great deal of respect for, I assume, though I haven't discussed this with her, that the reason she didn't do it was because she believed the state had the burden, because that's what the Illinois Supreme Court had said, and that's what the opinions of this court appear to say, that it's the burden of the state, whether at the trial level or at the post-conviction level, to prove competence.
And but see, that's where I want to get back to the first point that I made, because a lot of what you're arguing sounds to me like an argument for just kind of a freestanding procedural right to have the state go through things in a certain way. And by the time you get to post-conviction, it seems to me you're really focusing on the ultimate question. Was your client, was Mr. Reaver competent to stand trial? And we do have findings of fact from the state courts on that, about how he cooperated, he testified, he protected himself in part of his testimony, he didn't in other part. You know, there's all that stuff in the record. And so I guess what I'm worried about is some notion that there's this sort of abstract procedural right once we can actually get to the ultimate question. Or maybe to put it slightly differently, even if the procedures were not handled quite as they should have been, why is that prejudicial?
Well, Judge, I would say, just harkening back to what the Supreme Court has ruled, the Supreme Court in the two cases that are pertinent here, Pate and Drove, they said retrospective hearings don't work. This court has subsequently said, and the Illinois Supreme Court has said, well, sometimes they might. So that is, sometimes you can try 5 years right. later to recreate the scene. And I think it makes a very big difference whether you say, if you're going to allow that retrospective hearing, which so far the Supreme Court of the United States has never said is okay, but if you're going to allow it, at a minimum, you have to place the burden where it belongs, which is on the state, to show that 5 years later. If Your Honor says that's just a procedural issue, who has the burden of proof, then we lose, because there is no doubt, and I think it's very clear, that the post-conviction hearing that was held, Dr. Chapman testified, and what he testified very clearly is, it could be determined retrospectively, but not based on the record before the trial court, not based on the materials given to Dr. Chapman. So I really do, as crazy as it sort of seems, I think this case ultimately boils down to who had the burden of proof in the post-conviction proceedings. If we had the burden, we lose, and because of 2254E and the provision which Judge Mim rightly relied on, I can't argue. I tried to make an argument in the second part of my opening brief, but really, it doesn't work. The Supreme Court in the Williams case said, you know, even the fact that Ms. Davis probably should have put on the evidence, if she had to meet the burden, she failed to. That's really, Mr. Reaver, I think, suffers the consequence of that. There's some language in the Matheny case from this court, maybe not. But I really think we win, and I don't think Your Honors have to grant the petition in reverse, but I do think we have to go back to Judge Mim, and the burden has to be placed where the Lewis Court placed it, and say, and have the state prove, if it can, that in 2000 my client was competent for trial. And if they can, then I think the conviction has to be reversed and we need to be returned. If there's no further questions at this point, then I'll wait to rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Blackman. Ms. O'Connell.
May it please the Court, Assistant Attorney General Erin O'Connell on behalf of the respondent warden. Let's resolve whether Lewis versus Lane supplies the appropriate test. I think that opposing counsel has really narrowed the issues and made clear that he can really only prevail in this case if Lewis does apply. However, as Judge Wood suggested, Lewis is not a Supreme Court case, and it furthermore predates the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act. So to the extent that Lewis set forth a test for whether a petitioner should get a de novo federal hearing as to competency, that particular holding has been abrogated by the statute, which is Section 2254E2. So therefore, he must meet very stringent criteria for obtaining a new fitness hearing. He can't do so here because he failed to develop the record when he had the opportunity before the state court.
To the extent the state court's findings are influenced by its understanding of who has the burden of proof on the competency question, is there anything there? I mean, it does seem to me that's in part what Mr. Backman's getting at. So the state court makes some findings, but of course findings are going to be influenced by where the evidence comes in, you know, what happens to gaps and so on. And there are gaps. and Mr. Reaver doesn't present evidence to show, I mean, everything that he might have at the post-conviction hearing, but what if the burden should have been on the state? Wouldn't those findings have been different?
I guess I have a couple responses to that. First, I don't think that the state court did understand the burden to fall on the state. And, in fact, Lewis is the only case that I know of which would suggest that the burden does fall on the state as a matter of federal constitutional law. In the state post-conviction proceedings, the burden fell on the petitioner, as it does here, to prove that there was a constitutional violation that took place. And he failed to meet that burden. Now, Lewis doesn't apply. However, Matheny versus Anderson in the 2004 opinion is directly on point, that the court held in that case that where there's been a retrospective determination of competency that's entitled to the traditional AEDPA deference, this court must uphold that finding if it is reasonable in light of the facts that were before that court. Clearly, I would just touch on four major facts that do support that finding to be reasonable. The first is obviously that the defendant testified at his own trial. Now, this court has previously stated that this is a perfect example of a defendant who is fit because he's able to participate in his own defense.
How much of an inference can you draw about that for somebody who's bipolar and whose testimony may or may not reflect the kind of clear thinking that a normal person's would? It seems to me that for a long time, Mr. Reaver was suffering from really substandard lawyers, and even the trial court, the state trial judge himself says, you know, I blew it, you know, I think didn't really look into this the right way, should have tied up these things. At one point, the lawyer's standing there saying, I don't have a clue what this report means. You know, the lawyer's stipulating to things that are gibberish to him. It's not a record designed to make you have a lot of confidence in the outcome.
I think there are some strange comments that were made by counsel. However,
candid, you might say.
Yeah. So counsel believed that there was an ambiguity, that he just sort of sidestepped and he said, well, we're just going to stipulate to the report and defer to the ultimate finding that he's fit.
And why on earth did he do that?
I can't answer that question. He had before him this latest report which said unequivocally, clearly he's fit. And there was even no question at that point that the defendant was still depressed. However, that wasn't the issue. The issue isn't, is he suffering from mental illness? It's, is he fit? Can he assist his counsel? So counsel had before him this report, no question that he was fit. And then counsel...
And in the meantime, we're really playing around with his medications dramatically.
His medications were altered, but that goes along with this finding of, well, he is still suffering from symptoms. So if he left the DHS still suffering from symptoms of depression, those would be further alleviated through additional medications, but those don't bear on the issue of fitness.
Well, do they or don't they? I mean, suppose one of the side effects of either his mental state of bipolar disorder or the medications is a tendency to grandiosity, which is one of the, so far as I understand it, one of the things. So maybe he wants to get up in the stand and say, yeah, you know, I took her off and I beat her up and I did all this and that. But then he decides somewhere in his mind, you know, he draws the line. He doesn't want to say everything. I mean, do we have any kind of decent record on this?
On which point?
On what's the effect of these medications, especially when you triple or quadruple their dosages during the course of the trial. We have no evidence, do we?
The record could certainly be more complete on that point. However, there is no evidence that they would have a negative effect. And again, at the post-conviction hearing in state court, it was the petitioner's burden to prove that he was unfit at the time of trial, and he presented no evidence that would support such an inference that this medication would cause him to be having difficulties.
Maybe his biggest problem really is the fact that AEDPA says you can't rely on ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel.
Well, that's certainly, yes, an issue that he has to confront. However, he also has to confront all of the evidence that bears on the reasonableness of the state court's fitness determination, which at this point is more than sufficient to convince this court that it was reasonable, because we have the testimony at trial, and it's true that there might have been effects of his mental illness in terms of how he came across. However, he did significantly benefit his own cause by testifying, because he gained an acquittal of three of the sexual assault charges. So there must have been something about his testimony that was at least convincing somewhat to the jury.
What other evidence in the record was introduced by the defense? Anything other than his testimony?
By what supports the respondent's position?
I'm just wondering why you're attributing those acquittals solely to his testimony as opposed to anything else, you know, cross-examination of prosecution witnesses or other evidence introduced on behalf of the defense.
It's true that you can't necessarily tease out what was the determining factor. However, it's significant that he was acquitted of certain charges after he took the stand. And when he was testifying, he was up there for a significant period of time. It's actually in the record, his trial testimony, for this court to review. He was lucid. He gave competent responses. He understood the questions that were being posed. He maintained his story on cross-examination. So his position of, well, there was no sexual contact was something that he maintained throughout his testimony. And we have the trial judge's own observations where he says, I saw him testify. Clearly he was fit. There was nothing at any point that would indicate to me that there was any doubt as to his fitness at that point. And just to touch on a couple more that do support this finding of competency, we do have the latest and most recent psychological report, which is, again, unequivocal on the issue of fitness. There was findings in previous reports that suggested that he was unfit. However, the conditions that led to those findings, he was not being medicated at that time. However, that condition was alleviated by the antidepressant medication. And so we can see from the most recent psychological report that he was fit. And therefore, the trial court's finding was a reasonable one, and this court should affirm the district court's judgment denying habeas relief. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. O'Connell. Mr. Blackman?
Thank you, Your Honors. There are several points I want to cover as quickly as possible. I would say that, if anything, Mr. Evers' testimony led to his conviction of counts he shouldn't have been convicted on. The bottom line is the evidence that wasn't referred to by the state here, but that would have answered your question, Your Honor, is the tests, the medical testing of the victim. The doctors testified, it's in the record, they said it was impossible that she was sexually assaulted in the way the victim herself said she was sexually assaulted, because if she had been, there would have been bruises, and there were none. And the only semen found was a semen of her boyfriend, who she had been having sex with at the time of the jealous rage occurred. Again, no physical evidence. That's why he was acquitted of some of the sexual crimes. Why he was convicted of any is the mystery in this record. As to the Lewis case and this burden of proof issue, the state just misspeaks, unless they're trying to change the burden before your honors of what the Illinois Supreme Court has said it is. In my last footnote 5 of my reply brief, I cite the People v. Johnson case, 191 L. 2nd, 257. It holds, in post-conviction proceedings, the burden remains on the state to prove the fitness of my client. So the state just misspeaks when they say that we had the burden. We didn't. Now, that is an Illinois State Supreme Court case, I grant you, so how that applies at AEDPA and this court is something Your Honors will have to decide, but I would argue very strenuously that it would be unreasonable under the AEDPA for you to find that the state, Your Honors would have to find that it was unreasonable for the state courts to find that the state met its burden, because Dr. Chavin himself said you couldn't make that finding based on this record. And the last comment I'll make is the Supreme Court has said it, this court has said it, all courts have said it, the mere recollections 5 years later of a trial judge who at first wasn't even sure if he recollected the testimony. If you read the record, at first he's not sure, then he says, well, yeah, I think he did testify, then he has some recollections that it seemed to go pretty well. Those standing alone cannot meet that burden. So I would ask Your Honors to grant the writ and tell the state it either has to retry him or have a hearing to prove his fitness. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thanks, Mr. Backman. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement. The court will